Blog Talk Radio.
And hello out there to all you Brooklyn folk. This is Sam Maxwell, and you are here with the Bedford and Sullivan Podcast, the podcast that keeps you, the audience, active listeners in the Brooklyn Dodgers TV series research process. And this is our 91st episode, and as always, we are so proud to welcome in Brooklyn Dodgers pitcher Carl Erskine. And Carl, I was just telling you off air, but I'll tell all of our listeners as well. We have 91 episodes, and you have been on the most, and that is 12. You have been on 12. I was counting right beforehand. So I can't thank you enough for joining us as often as you do.
If the good fortune had been 92, you would have matched my birthday.
Yeah, right, exactly. I was thinking the same thing, but we're one off, and maybe, you know, we can – you're 92 years young, but we can say you're 91 for this episode.
That's good.
Well, happy July 4th to you and your family, Carl. And I thought that we could come on close to the holiday and kind of just, you know, go from there about some of your July 4th memories, whether it's Brooklyn Dodgers related, whether anything pops into your head, or just, you know, natural American holiday memories?
Well, of course, you go back to the 1940s and 50s, there was always a standard holiday menu for baseball, doubleheaders. We played doubleheaders on, I think, all major holidays. And, of course, July 4th, right in the middle of the season, I'm sure most of my 12 seasons in the majors that we played a doubleheader on the 4th of July. And instead of celebrating with a picnic, that had to come later when we would find an off day sometime. But, well, July, in those days, the dugouts were not conditioned with air conditioning. If you're playing in St. Louis on 4th of July, it had to be near 100 degrees or more. And there's an old saying that if the dugouts were very hot, and but they were 20 degrees hotter if you were behind. So, there's a lot of memories about the old dugouts. And, of course, I found this out later. The fans are amazing. The fans have called me over the years and told me things about my career that I never read, heard, or remembered. And just recently, I had a call. This fan was very astute. He researched and he knew the Dodgers inside and out. And he said to me, in 1953, it was my only 20-game season, but I got off to a kind of a rocky start, and I was only 5-4 at the All-Star break. Well, you know, the All-Star break comes in July, in the middle of July. But he said, Carl, did you realize that in July of 1953, you won 6 games in July? I said, no kidding. He said, not only that, you saved the game. And then, you had four complete games in July and a total of 6 wins. Well, that made up a lot for what I didn't get in the first half of the season. And, so the second half of the season, I was 15-2. That's unbelievable. But when you mentioned July to me, now I remember something that I didn't know happened only because of a fan reminding me about my career. So I appreciate the calls and letters I get from fans, emails. They're always telling me something that I don't remember about my own career.
Well, you really made an impact on a lot of fans just from posting this this on certain Brooklyn Dodgers Facebook groups. Everybody immediately goes, "Oi!"
even in my hometown here, Randerson, Indiana, which is right in the middle of the Midwest, I can be on a street or pumping gas at a station, and I'll hear a voice calling to me, "Hey, Ollie!"
Right.
Believe it or not, the Brooklynese have found its way in Indiana.
Well, you know, there's a few connections with the Dodgers. Of course, we always talk about your Indiana compadre, Mr. Gil Hodges, and I want to get to Gil in a little bit, but just because I thought it would, because he's going to be up for the Hall of Fame once more, I thought that would be apropos to talk about. But 1953, it's hard for pitchers to get MVP votes, and just to let you know, you were ninth in the MVP voting that year. I think that says a lot about how valuable you were in the year of 1953.
I always felt like, not because I had my best year there, but in 53, but if you looked at the numbers of the lineup that year, it had fantastic numbers. And I think five different players drove in 100 runs. I could be corrected there, and I'm sure I will be now that we said it on the air.
I got the numbers up in front of me. It looks like Carl Fiorello got close with 92, but according to the starting lineup, you had Roy Campanella at 142, Gil Hodges at 122, and Duke Snider at 126. Jackie Robinson did have 95 that year.
Okay, well, there's five that you might as well say drove in 100 runs.
Right.
And so that team, offensively, I think we scored over an average of 6 runs a game that season. And that was only half the story. You know, baseball does not say much about one of the most brilliant displays that they put on the field every day, and that's defense. There is such marvelous defense today at baseball. There was in my day, but the infields were not manicured like they are today. The grass wasn't clipped like it is today. The gloves weren't as big and as light as they are today. The infielders wear fairly big gloves today, and they're very light. Some of them are made out of kangaroo hide, which is a very thin, very light material. But the defense in baseball, and we're speaking here in 2019, the defense today, even in the top minor leagues, is absolutely one of the most beautiful things to watch. It's almost like a acrobatic performance, especially around second base.
Mm-hmm.
Outfield catches and of course the shift has taken down some of the spectacular plays because they're all bunched in one part of the field, and the plays that come to them are not always very difficult because of the concentration of fielders. But I just think baseball needs to blow the horn a little bit louder about the marvelous experience to watch a game and see the defensive plays. Of course, the pros make them look so easy. I don't think the fans appreciate how good some of these plays really are.
Well, that's actually a good segue, too, to players like Gil Hodges and even in more modern times, Keith Hernandez, and how when it comes to the Hall of Fame, you have a player like Keith Hernandez who batted something along the lines of 300 for his entire career, but also strung together about 11 straight gold gloves. And yet there's never been a proper measurement of defense from a statistical standpoint, and all these offensive numbers are what a lot of voters have used when it comes to the Hall of Fame. But that seems to be changing, and I think it gives a place for the Veterans Committee to once again reassess Gil Hodges' Hall of Fame credentials, especially when compared to his contemporaries at the time.
Well, Gil was a quiet man, and his personality in Brooklyn just was able to somehow, the chemistry between how he played defense he went through some tremendous slumps, and the fans never booed Hodges in Ebbets Field. And we all thought that that was, he was the only person ever played at Ebbets Field that never was subject to a boo sometime in their career. But the fans picked up on this chemistry of this quiet big man just doing his job every day, good or bad at the plate, but he was, his defense was flawless. And how many outs he recorded that were bad throws from the infielders trying to make a tough play. He would dig them out of the dirt. His reach was long. He was a big man, and he could reach and still touch the base. So he saved so many throws at first base, which is not in the record book. But his major contribution, besides being an outstanding player, you know, he was the premier first baseman in all the 1950s. There was not another first baseman in the league that was recognized at first base like Hodges during the 1950s. But the thing he did that is not in the record book, and I watched this happen over and over, in the early years of Jackie's experience in the big leagues, there was a lot of plays around second base where there was a lot of bodies flying in and out, and there was always a tension in the early years of some kind of confrontation at second base with Jackie. Mm-hmm. And players did fly slide extra hard, and there was a lot of body contact down there. Well, Hodges was a peacemaker. And unspoken, the league players in the National League coming to Ebbets Field respected Hodges. He was just that kind of a person that was respected. So he would go down to second base when there was a pile up, and he'd throw bodies off of the pile to prevent an outbreak. And to me, Pee Wee Reese was a very, very genuine Hall of Famer on his own, no question. But there was always a tagline with Pee Wee, and he played alongside of Jackie Robinson. Well, so did Hodges on the other side play alongside of Jackie. And he kept peace on the infield in these early years when there could have been a fight that Mr. Ricky prayed would never happen. But he said, Jackie, if you ever fight on the field, our experiment is done. We're going to fail. Hodges, historically, should get lots of credit for keeping the peace on the infield. Now, I know that doesn't interpret into votes for the Hall of Fame, but at the same time, historically, they should not forget that Gil Hodges, the quiet man, made a quiet strength on the infield that prevented lots of potential fights that could have spoiled the whole Jackie Robinson story. And I wish I could preach this sermon to the committee.
Yeah, and that should be brought up in some, you know, you're the first one that I've spoken to that has brought it up. You know, Gil Jr. was on the podcast talking about his father's Hall of Fame credentials. And he's good about the fact that, unfortunately, his father, you know, tragically was not able to put together a managerial career that was that had length enough to really be considered specifically for managerial purposes. But I believe combined with what you're talking about, combined with the stats as a first baseman at the time, and he would just produce runs after runs every year. I think that the combination of 1969 as well as his playing career puts him over the top in my book. And the stuff that you're discussing regarding the Jackie Robinson experiment that was extremely successful, I think is just that many more cherries on top. There's at least 14 cherries to also use the number, Gil Hodges' number.
That's interesting. Well, the fans have an influence, I think, on the committee, because the committee members that vote now, some of them, of course, were not able to see Gil play, and that's a disadvantage when you're trying to vote somebody on the Hall of Fame. But also, Hodges, he was a, I've often said this, when I looked around the team when I was on the mound, and Campanella was catching, Hodges was at first base, Jackie was at second, Pee Wee was at short. Now, any one of those players I just mentioned could have been captain or could have been a manager. Campanella would have been an excellent manager if his life hadn't been shortened in baseball by the accident he had. Hodges, of course, became a manager. And Jackie was a candidate to be a manager and smart enough to be a manager. Pee Wee would have been an excellent manager. So we had this group of guys on the infield that I think the infield itself ought to be in the Hall of Fame.
Right.
The problem with the Hall of Fame, in my mind, is they will not combine the career of a manager who was also a player. They will not combine the two in looking at Hall of Fame stats, and I think that's wrong. I think that a person like Gil, who played tremendously over a long period of time and then became the miracle manager of the Mets and was spoken about by the players, Tom Seavers and others on that Mets team, that he was a character builder. He did far more than teach baseball. And I think if you don't combine the two, you don't get the impact of how a player contributed to the game. And so I always objected to the fact that they wouldn't consider a player either as a manager or a player. But there's been several managers who are also great players. And I think they should be combined. And in Hodges' case, that would help him.
You can't talk about 1969 with the players who were part of that team without them bringing up Gil Hodges within a matter of seconds. It's clear what he meant to them. And they still to this day get very emotional about his life cut short, and it's. I'm just hoping that finally, especially with Jones still around, that they can do justice to the Hodges family as well as Brooklyn themselves. And I'd like to go around the horn too. I'm kind of curious your thoughts about to tangent a little bit about Billy Cox, the third baseman on the infield. Considering, obviously he was a little lighter offensively, but, he hit .291 in the year of 1953. And I'm kind of curious your thoughts about Billy Cox.
It's interesting you mentioned him because I did not mention him when I was talking about the great infield. But the greatest lineup the Dodgers ever had in Brooklyn included Billy Cox in my mind. And in order to get Jackie's bat in the lineup in the later years, in the latter part of the 1950s, in order to get Jackie's bat in the lineup, he actually played left field. I bet you a lot of people would remember that Robinson played left field. And I'm not positive of this, but I think even in a couple of World Series games, Jackie played left field. But to have the lineup with Jackie in it, and also Billy Cox, because Cox played third base, which was Jackie's position late in his career, but Jackie would play left field. And when I looked at that lineup, I say that was Gilliam, who led off, and Reese, who hit second, and Duke Snyder hit third, and then Jackie, I think, hit fourth. When that lineup, when you put that lineup on paper and look at the stats, and that includes Billy Cox. Now, the one thing that happened to Billy, he was very quiet. He didn't say much at all. He and Preacher Rowe roomed together, and we used to watch Preacher and Billy Cox in the restaurant when we eating together. They never talked. They ate it never. They weren't so one of them wants a salt shaker, and he just start pointing, and the other one hand it over. We said, look, they don't have, they never talk about anything on the meeting together. But Billy was very, very quiet. And, you know, he had a few home runs. I don't know how many, I don't remember. But he was a pretty good offensive player to be as good an infielder. Now, who was a better third baseman in the league in those years and later years than Billy Cox? It was Brooks Robinson. Now, both of those two third basemen had the quickest hands. And Billy Cox had tremendous quick hands. And he used a kind of a small glove, actually. It was small compared to some other infielders. But his hands were so quick. But the thing Cox could not do that Brooks Robinson was a master at was the range. Robinson had great range. Of course, he was a bigger man and a longer reach. But Cox was anything that Cox could reach, he had it. He didn't know ever. He was just that quick. And but in comparison to the two, the only real difference to me was range. Brooks Robinson just had a wider range. He got two more balls than Billy might have got to. But Cox was kind of covered up with, you know, every spring training, when we go to spring training, there was always the writers talking about third base is going to be challenged now. Bobby Morgan might be the third baseman. Or they traded, we traded and got Randy Jackson for the Cubs. He was going to be a third baseman. And so Cox was always on the bubble. Is he going to stay or is he going to be replaced? And that's not a comfortable place to be in when you're a player, to have the writers talking about who's going to replace me. But Cox always kind of came through, and he had a nice long career with the Dodgers. And he is a man who is kind of forgotten in terms of the superstars that were the Brooklyn Dodgers.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned 1963, and you were talking about how Jackie went to the outfield. He is listed here on the 1953 baseball reference page as having been one of the three outfielders, Jackie Robinson, Duke Snider, Carl Parrillo. And so you have Billy Cox at third base, and you have Jim Gilliam at second base. Now, I decided to see whether there was a game played today because, obviously, like you said, there were doubleheader scheduled then. And there was a doubleheader scheduled on July 4th. But would you know what, Carl? There was a game on Thursday, July 2nd in Brooklyn. 9,223 fans got to see you win your second got to see the Dodgers win the second game in a row. And guess who pitched that day, Carl?
Well, I don't know. My arm just twitched. Maybe it wasn't me.
Oh, yeah. No, you beat the Philadelphia Phillies 8-0 on Thursday, July 2nd at Ebbets Field. Does anything come to mind regarding that? Now, of course, I have your pitching line here right now.
Well, that was one of 350 games or so that I was in during my 12th season, so sometimes it's hard to pick out. But you know, the Phillies, I pitched, I don't know if Roberts happened to pitch that day, but it seemed like I teamed up against Robin Roberts several times with the Phillies. And I had a pretty good lifetime record of the Phillies. I think I was like 22-9 or something against the Phillies. And they had a good inning ball club, too. Andy Siminick used to give me some trouble, the catcher for the Phillies. I'd make a bad pitch on Andy Siminick, and he'd make me pay. But, yeah, well, that stretch in July of 53, you know, it was just unreal to me. I mentioned I was 5-4 the first half of the season, and Dressen, the manager, came to me one day and he said, "Hey, the All-Star break's coming up, and you've been snake bit the first half. You pitched a lot of good ball game, and you didn't get to win, or you got a no you'd have no decision. But I'm going to take you fishing on over the All-Star break to a friend of mine upstate. I'm going to take you fishing and change your life. By God, I came back in the second half of the season. I was 15-2. And I could have won another three or four, maybe two or three games at least, because we cinched the pennant early in 53. And I had about three or four starts before the World Series. And so they would let me pitch the first three or four innings just to keep in tune, but they wouldn't let me stay in the game to get the win. So I, you know, think of myself, two or three times I came out having pitched four innings and had maybe a three or four run lead. But I Dressen was trying to bring Joe Black along. And so he bring Joe in, give him a chance to pick up a win. And that was okay. That didn't bother me. But that second half of the season in 53, which included a big July for me, I would have not remembered that had a fan not reminded me of winning six games in July.
Well, this was your sixth win of the year. You had 14 shutouts, I believe is what it lists. You had 14 shutouts over your career. This was one of them, nine-inning shutout. And you faced Carl Drews that day. And something interesting about the lineup, Carl, is the fact that you were mentioning Jackie Robinson was in the outfield. But what's so interesting about today was that Billy Cox did not play at third base. Jackie Robinson did. And Gil Hodges played left field that day.
Well, now that's a day I don't remember. I don't remember Hodges ever playing in the outfield.
Isn't that interesting? And I'm wondering whether it got moved around later on in the game. You know, these things, they have all that type of stuff. And I'm trying to see. But no, it looks like most likely, obviously, there's some things it just doesn't pick up on. But it looks like then you played the outfield, left field, the entire game. And it's so interesting the way that the stars align. The day that I interview you, you mentioned 1953, and it looks like you started your July, your fantastic 1953 July, with a win on this particular, at the time, Thursday.
Yeah. Well, you know, those years are a long time ago. And my wife says to me, Carl, you missed three things on the grocery list. How do you remember all that stuff about the game you pitched back 65 years ago? I said, well, you know, when you go through the fire, you don't forget a lot. But I'll tell you what, I was a kid that never quit being a kid. When I got to the big leagues, and I was 21 years old, I was like a little kid that got into the candy store. And, I mean, I was so enamored at the fact that I was in the major leagues. I'm playing with one of the great teams. Because those things didn't historically mean so much as they do now. But to play with that great lineup, it was just every day I was just like a kid. And I never left that feeling. And in fact, playing 14 years, counting a couple seasons in the minors and 12 in the majors, I never lost that feeling. And even as we speak, I get that feeling that how rare and how fortunate to have played in the major leagues, to play with such a team, and played on the biggest stage, which is New York. I was always thankful that I got to play in New York.
And you keep us young, Carl, after 91 episodes. This is always spectacular to talk to you about this. And you know, as we will continue to speak of wherever we decide to go about the your time as a major leaguer. And thank you so much for always joining us. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you. And to relive some of those moments is a beautiful feeling for me. So I'll remember you, Sam, on the 4th of July.
Same here. Give my best to your family. And thank you all to your listeners for listening to us on the Bedford and Sullivan podcast. Have a wonderful 4th of July to your family and all your friends. Take care, everybody. Thanks again.